Hi there, I'm K-Town, and on this edition of Mysterious Radio.
Okay, the Montauk Project is an effort by my co-author, Preston Nichols, to figure out his life. So in one sense, you begin with his, you know, strange experiences, which led him to understand and study the Philadelphia experiment. So you could say that it begins with Preston, but it also begins with the Philadelphia experiment.
For those that don't know what the Philadelphia experiment is, and you know, I've seen movies on it and things, so this is really an educational type interview for me too. I don't know, you know, as far as like, if there's ever been anything created, you know, in film that really tells the true story about what happened there, but can you tell us about that?
Well, actually, according to witnesses who have watched there was a newsreel that still exists. You won't be able to find it easily, certainly not on YouTube, of the Philadelphia experiment as recorded by the U.S. Navy when it actually occurred. But what it was a multi-layered endeavor. But the most common interpretation of it is they were trying to make a ship appear invisible to enemy radar during World War II because the Nazis were shooting down ships. So they were putting degaussing coils, which means to demagnetize the hull so that it wouldn't record on radar or sonar. And that's what the Philadelphia experiment was. However, because it was literally changing the dynamics of electromagnetic fields, it resulted in a space-time teleportation of the ship and the sailors aboard it. And that's what made it so spectacular. That's what the popular film called The Philadelphia Experiment is based upon, that general idea.
Looking at that film, do you think it's accurate or did they sensationalize that?
Well, of course, they sensationalize it and take creative license with it. But it was so authentic to at least to some point, the rhyme and reason of it, that it caused Al Bielek to stir up his actual memories of the actual experiment when he claimed that he was aboard the ship. So he was one of the perpetrators of the story of the Philadelphia experiment and the Montauk Project, both.
You know, I know personally, I try to go back through YouTube and find things with Al Bielek in it, and they have buried it. Like, even in, I look back and I know like 2 years ago, I was able to find a ton of stuff, but now it's like totally buried. And I know you've probably had to realize that as well. Okay, so you said there's an authentic video somewhere. It won't be hard. I mean, it won't be easy to find, but it's out there somewhere. So I'm going to make an effort to find it.
Well, yes, it showed in newsreels, people that were alive and saw it, you know, when they were young, when they showed it in movie theaters. One of my friends, her parents owned a movie theater. She remembered it. There was also, it was by report of a friend of mine had seen it when it was released with the Philadelphia Experiment movie, the premiere of it in Philadelphia. They showed it the newsreel. So, and of course it was, you know, confiscated, or, you know, it was hushed up because it was too revealing.
And do you remember, like, what were the actual firsthand accounts of what people witnessed that day?
Well, there were many different accounts that were recorded, but it was basically the ship disappeared in the Philadelphia Naval Yard and then was said to have reappeared off the coast of Norfolk, Virginia, where there's a big naval base, and some reports had it in off the coast of Montauk, New York. These are, you know, hearsay accounts, but certainly something happened. And there have been so many instances of this story, sailors disappearing in a bar. This appeared in a newsletter, Navy newsletter, I think it was called The Beacon, that was printed out of the Philadelphia Naval Yard. So these things are very obscure to find, but I've heard so many of them that it's hard to believe that it didn't occur reasonably as we've been told.
Wow, that is amazing. Do you know if there were instances of people or things disappearing and never reappearing again?
Well, yes, there are stories of that, but what made the Philadelphia experiment so, I guess, sensational or so traumatic at the same time, and what started the research that actually began the Montauk Project, was people, how they responded to being in a rotating electromagnetic field that literally teleported them out of this dimension. And there is very clear science behind that, how theoretically that could happen. And when people left this dimension, they lost what are called their time references. Like, you know, you're locked into time right now. This is what's stable for us. If you were to start losing your time references, you know, you might be and all of a sudden find yourself at 6 o'clock in the evening, or might go sit down, eat breakfast, and you're eating dinner. This can really disturb a person psychologically. So these people were psychologically disturbed, and many of them were brought to a facility on Long Island that was known as Camp Upton during World War I. It was a convalescent hospital. It was in Yaphank, which was not only a major compound for pre-World War II Germans, the Nazi party in Long Island, the biggest conclave of Nazis outside of Germany in the 1930s. It was also what became the area of Brookhaven National Laboratory, the premier atomic research facility in the United States. So this is where the sailors were brought, and they were brought to study what was called the human factor. Why did the mind of man go nuts when it was subjected to electromagnetic fields of such high degree and also outside of this reality?
Wow, unbelievable. Let me ask you about this scientist. Okay, so you just jarred my memory there. You mentioned the coils. Was that done in conjunction with something that Tesla invented? I mean, who were the scientists, top scientists involved in that?
Well, there was a man named T. Townsend Brown and Nikola Tesla and John von Neumann. And of course, Tesla is said to have bowed out of the experiment because he knew that it would be very damaging to humans. And this was, you know, he died before the final experiment, and he was taken out by the U.S. government. They actually revoked his citizenship because he was not in agreement with what they wanted to do. And he was killed, and all of his papers and most of his papers, not all of his papers, but some of them, the key ones, went to Yugoslavia before he died.
Okay.
So but he was, go ahead.
Okay, you said Yugoslavia. Okay, so that threw me for a loop. So it wasn't our government that did it?
Oh, no, the government. The United States government did the experiment, but I'm saying Tesla gave some of his best research to his home country of Yugoslavia.
Got you, okay.
And they had their own secret technology and space program. Is why they were able to resist the Soviet Union when all the other communist countries bowed down to them.
Okay, but our government, you said he was took out, our government did that?
Yes. And of course, you can look at old Superman cartoons where Tesla was the evil scientist. He was called Tesla. He was not Lex Luthor. So Tesla was and there's even a vampire movie. I think it's called Mark of the Vampire or Return of the Vampire, when Bela Lugosi plays a vampire called Tesla. So they were black PRing Tesla. This is in the 1940s.
There's another one that came out too, a series. It's called The Man Who Fell to Earth. And I guarantee you that's about Tesla. I think it's about Tesla. And there's another one. Who was it? The other scientist?
T. Townsend Brown, John von
Neumann. No, not during that time. But there was another scientist. I'll think of it in a minute. But anyway, that was That's a good one. If you haven't checked that out, maybe I'll send that one to you. Okay. And so let's talk about Preston here. Tell us who Preston is and how did he get involved in it?
Okay. Preston Nichols, very fascinating character who was a savant genius when it came to electronics, electromagnetics. He was one of the foremost experts on electromagnetics in the world. And he could talk straight science, very straight science on the highest level of, you know, your PhDs. He could also embrace the, you know, weird physics or physics that's outside of the realm of that. And he could, you know, interbridge the two. So he was quite a genius as a scientist. He had a lot of paranormal experiences. And he worked in sound engineering as a young boy. He recorded The Twist, Chubby Checker's The Twist, as a young man. And he had experiences where he felt that he was taken to the Pleiades and given a scientific education far beyond what you'd find in a university. And then he emerged as a young person, still in the sound industry, sound recording industry, but he had was recruited to work at Brookhaven National Labs for a while. He ended up working for Airborne Instruments Laboratory, which was one of the premier defense contractors in Long Island. And there he discovered he had two realities, because people started to recognize him from working at Montauk, and he didn't know what they were talking about. He says, well, what are you talking about? Yeah, you were my boss at Montauk. No, I wasn't. What are you? And it actually evolved into a fight, almost a fight, at the dinner table he was having with his cousin. And I eventually met his cousin at his mother's funeral, and she did verify the story that her ex-husband had gotten very angry. And Preston had gotten very angry at him because he insisted that he work for him at Montauk. He knew nothing about Montauk. So that is a little bit about Preston, and was very confused. But as he began to investigate, he began to realize that he had another life that he knew nothing about.
Okay. Was this in like close proximity? I mean, this had to be in the same timeline, right? Like something running parallel he was already experiencing.
It was not on the same timeline. It's like if you were sitting here doing a radio show and doing whatever radio interviews you do in a day, and then you found out that, you know, you had a secret life where you were working as a congressman or something and doing in the world. Or helping do in the world. And then you say, what the hell is this? It's not on this timeline. And you're trying to correlate these two realities. Of course, the fact is he was dealing with the science of time, and the science of mind. And when I say mind, this is how human beings perceive. And this is what was dealing with, because I had mentioned time references, and anybody who's had the misfortune or arguably fortune to take a hallucinogenic drug or even something as cannabis can see time can go by like still, you know, frames in a movie, just bup, 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 bup. You can see time literally slow down in almost cartoonish way or even speed up. So that is the perception of the human mind. So when you begin to access that reference frame of perception, and then you begin to mix and match it with different radio frequencies and influencing not only the perception, but influencing the person, it creates a lot of potentials for potentially exotic demonstrations of phenomena.
Man, this is interesting here. Okay, so he started getting all the people were telling him that he was some type of boss at this Montauk project. Did he even know what the Montauk project was?
No. What had happened was he was experimenting with psychic phenomena in his laboratory, which was actually a huge extended garage on the back of the property. And he had sound equipment in there also. I mean, it was like a museum of radio. It was incredible. just even the feeling to be in there. But basically, he would experiment with these psychics, and he would find out every day they were blocked at 3 o'clock. Well, they just couldn't do anything. So he got a radio direction finder, and he began to say, what is the signal? Let me see if there's a signal that's blocking them. He followed it 2 hours away from his house all the way out to the eastern end of Long Island and saw that the radio direction finder was pointing to the Montauk Tower or the Montauk Transmitter Tower, which was this huge, almost the size of a football field antenna that lurks over. It's a reconnaissance point for ships to this day because it stands out much more prominent than the lighthouse at the end of the Long Island. So he found that there was this signal emanating from there. This is in the probably the very early 80s, 1979, early 80s, he finds this. Or no, this would have been in it's sometime in the 80s he discovers this. And he says, wow. And then as he finds this, he goes out to the base, he takes his different psychics out to the base, and they begin to decipher what had happened at this location. But this would have been, I believe, 1983, because this is when they found that all of the equipment was strewn across the base. The project was over, but they found all of this equipment that was just strewn about and never taken care of. It was like somebody had ransacked the place and thrown everything. And he began to grab up the equipment, take it back, and slowly piece together his other life where he was involved in so much of the technology for the Montauk Project.
Got you. And okay, so I'm looking at that chapter that is titled Project Moonbeam. Did he take the route of maybe having some regression done to help him recover some of his memories?
Well, he was more into regressing others than getting regressed himself. He might have done that to some extent, but where he had his big breakthrough was when, I will preface this by saying that one of the things we're not able to put into the original book, which is now in the book that you have, the Silver Anniversary Edition, which is available at Amazon. But that book, we put in that book that the new edition is that he worked at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, Airborne Instruments Laboratory, AIL. Now, that is where he found out that he walked in one day, I guess he passed security clearance, and he found he had an office as vice president, which he was just a technician. So he got past this secure area by mistake. And he found out he had an office with all of this data and information, and which included the Philadelphia experiment. I can also tell you from knowing him that part of his job, and he would never, ever say this publicly, but I know it to be true, at least according to his own reality, is that he was assigned to study the Philadelphia experiment because he could never talk about it because he had he was signed an agreement not to talk about classified stuff. And he had to study the Philadelphia experiment because that was the invisible techniques that they used in the stealth aircraft, which was, of course, to make an airplane disappear. So it doesn't disappear to radar, it actually disappears. And this was one of his great secrets that he took to the grave with him, all of that information, all the bloody details of the Philadelphia experiment, which he studied. But as he did study or find out of his secret identity, he began to build a pyramidal antenna structure over his laboratory. And this was like an octahedral antenna. And it was called a delta T antenna. The T refers to time, delta refers to change. So it was a changing time antenna. And he had coils going around, three different coils going around the three different, pathways of the outer aspects of the antenna. And what this resulted in for him, I think he said he passed out and all these memories started coming back. That's kind of how he got so much of his memory back, was working on this time flux antenna. And like when he was in that antenna, like literally constructing it and putting up coils, he was beginning to perceive different timelines and that which he was involved in. And that's how his memory came back.
Man, he needs a movie about his life, big time. Okay, so let me ask you something about his, who was he working for anyway in this? Was it the Department of Defense? I mean, who was he working for?
Oh, Airborne Instruments Laboratory was a defense contractor.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. They were, I remember, you know, I think they were, I'm getting confused as to who their ownership was at that time. But nevertheless, they were a very heavy-duty defense contractor. And much of, if most of it's gone, but back in when I began to investigate this, if you went out to the Montauk Transmitter Building, you'd see a lot of labels on equipment and stuff that would say Airborne Instruments Laboratory or Sperry. Sperry and or Airborne Instruments Laboratory were two of the big contractors. Sperry later became Unisys. And then it moved from Long Island. It might have even moved into Mexico. I don't know. But, you know, these corporations changed their name. But Sperry at the time and AIL were two big, huge defense contractors. Now, when I say Airborne Instruments Laboratory, it's very important to understand that airborne instruments have to do with instruments that are aboard, like an airplane or another aeronautical craft. So these had to do... Sperry was gyroscopes. So you had, and of course, a gyroscope is rotating vis-a-vis the spin of the Earth. And the spin of the Earth is what we're all, is what actually makes us experience the time we do. That's a scientific, you know, without rotation, we don't have time. And it completely, the rotation of any planet creates the space-time field that it's in. So when they were working with those, and of course on airborne instruments, they're working with this to just balance the plane so it can fly in the physical universe. But there are potentials beyond that, and that's what they were using with the Montauk project.
I'm interested to know about his... you said he was taken to, or he believed that he was taken to the Pleiades for some type of higher...
That's correct.
Higher education.
Yeah, and that is in a book called Encountering the Pleiades, which is currently out of print, which will be going back into print soon on print on demand. But that's a book about his UFO experiences. And he had a certain ability with electronics as a young person. And it was far above the, you know... average person. And I remember one time when it was his birthday, and my wife at the time, we went to buy him something for his birthday, and she went to a Big and Tall Man store to buy him, you know, some dress clothes or something. And she went in there and she got talking to the person. She was saying who it was for. And the person remembered, oh, Preston Nichols. I think she called him Penny. Penny, she says, oh, he was a genius. God, he was a genius. She remembered him from school. She went to school with him. And of course, then we found out, that's how we found out his name was Penny Nichols. That's what his nickname was, because his name was Nichols. It was his last name. And yeah, his father would call him Penn. And yeah, we didn't know that at the time. That's how we found out his nickname. But his experience in the Pleiades was I don't remember how it happened right now, but he felt that he was taken there and given a scientific education. What his father told me, because I knew his father, he was alive for quite a while when I was doing the research and stuff, and his father said, and his father always called himself the Doubting Thomas of this. He never really quite, you know, was on board, he said. By the end of his life, he was. But he said that Preston, his knowledge accelerated beyond belief all of a sudden. He was always very good with electronics, but then he went from like a typical engineer to like an Einstein type, you know, where he just, I'm just showing the comparison between an Einstein and a typical engineer. They're both smart, but Einstein is like heralded as this complete, utter genius. So I'm saying it just went like boom off the charts. And he witnessed this. All of a sudden his son was like super intelligent instead of just intelligent. And that's, you know, just getting educated in whatever they educated him in. And he could have very interesting discussions about such things.
So he was, let me just stay there for just one moment. Did he discuss that publicly? I mean, did he tell people, I think I was taken and educated by some type of alien race, or was that something he kept to himself?
Well, no, he talked about it. I kind of had to get it out of him to a certain extent because it was stuff that he kind of talked about to me privately. He might have talked about it at lectures that were not super well attended. But I said, we should tell the story. This is how it became a book, because I said, we've got to tell your story here. It's interesting. He didn't think it was interesting. You know, he did not have a good, I guess what you'd say, assessment of what was interesting or what people would want to know. He could miss the boat on this. This was not his skill set. Was assessing. He could give a very interesting lecture, but his expertise was not in what people would want to hear or should want to hear. And so he could discount the most magnificent things and trump up the most
insignificant,
not interesting things. Exactly. And I've seen this with other people who were involved in very high level security projects that had nothing to do with the U.S. government.
The reason why I'm asking, Peter, is because I'm wondering, like, if he truly believed it happened, you know, he would be more than happy, probably, you know, if it wouldn't affect his career in one way or another to talk about it. But if people are kind of doubting what they have experienced, you know, they are kind of reluctant to even repeat it to someone else. So you got the feeling that
I don't think he doubted what he experienced.
Okay.
What there was a certain amount of fear, because when I was putting together this book and telling him, because by this time he was pretty much fading away. He didn't have much left in him in terms of survival. You know, he was dying slowly. Not anyway, I said, and he could still talk and whatnot. And I remember telling him, look at Preston, I'm doing this new edition of the book, which he was all in favor of. I said, I'm going to put in about, you know, you're participating in Airborne Instruments Laboratory, that was the name. Now, he says, I don't think that's a good idea. I said, Preston, it's like 25 years later. Nobody cares anymore. I mean, that's all gone. It's all water under the bridge. You know, nobody cares. You know, the people that would have put the screws on, nobody's going to put any screws on him. And then I actually visited him in person. And this was probably maybe within a year of his death. And I said, Preston, it's, you know, in the first book, we stated that you had a 30-year non-disclosure agreement when you signed that at AIL that you could not talk. I said, that 30 years is now up. This is about the Philadelphia experiment. I said, you cannot talk about it. And he goes, oh, it's 50 years. It was 50 years. He just made that up. It wasn't 50 years. He didn't want to talk about it. And the reason he didn't want to talk about it, because he was afraid that he might get in trouble. Even though, you know, he's now an old man and nobody's going to bother him. He's only got about a year to live. He was still afraid on some level. Yes, he did suffer trauma. Induced mind control, which makes him a tricky subject to work with, because, you know, people can say, oh, he's all mind control. He does. He's just talking, you know, talking bull. And no, you have to, he wasn't talking bull. Sometimes he would, but this becomes the great challenge.
Was he saying that because maybe he knew of some people who talked and were harmed in one way or another, or was he just something in his mind?
Yes. Many instances of that in his reality. But what I'm saying is, you know, his life was up. was and he knew it wasn't going to be much.
It wasn't
going
to affect him. Yeah, they weren't.
Yeah, yeah.
Touch
and him. I mean, it was very clear to me that he wasn't risking anything. But by that time, his even though he wasn't totally gone, and he'd have, from what I've heard from other people who lived around him, he'd have good moments and bad moments. And I was always told he'd have very good moments with me because I had a business relationship with him and a good relationship with other people. He wasn't necessarily so, alert and attentive. And, but, I mean, I clearly see, it's just like, when you get old, you fade away, you don't calculate, properly. So anyway, that sort of, there was, it was also part of his game to be secretive because it was just kind of, he lived in a world of secrecy and conspiracy. But that's just, he was an interesting character, and he paved the way towards, more discoveries for myself.
I want to talk about chapter 10, where, you have in here the Syrians. Syrians are, is that an alien race?
Well, there was so much alien lore about the Montauk Project, and why I say lore, that's legend, that's the people, but the way the people involved with it that I knew or that were in and or around Spacetime Labs and Preston's lectures and stuff basically talked about aliens kind of rather matter-of-factly or offhand. But where it first came, And none of these people really talked about it that much. They didn't really talk about it. It was not supposed to be talked about. So I'm at this guy's house one day. There's some sort of talk going on, not about Montauk. And this guy approaches me. His name was George Dixon. And he took me aside into the kitchen. And he says, how's the book coming along? And I said, oh, it's coming along fine. I was writing. He says, well, I want you to know I was involved with the chair, procuring the chair. He says, I ran I was in charge of a financial account and I secured the chair. I said, okay, all right. And I thought, okay, I didn't know if he was on the level or what. It was a very weird sort of confession. And then I went back to Preston and told him, and he was with his, collaborator Duncan Cameron, the psychic, and I was telling both of them, and they said, he told you that? I said, yeah. Like, I first thought they were saying, how dare he tell it? And I said, well, that's incredible. That's the first time he's ever told anybody outside of us. And basically, when I told my wife the story, she says, oh, he must have been the one who got the chair from the aliens. And yeah, it was like, how he got the chair from the aliens, how it was put into his hand, who the hell knows? I don't know. It was like this chair was supposedly alien technology. And whether that was a cover story for, technology from, a Third Reich or the Axis powers, I don't know. If it was screen memories, if it was Earth technology, or if it was indeed from an alien race. But certainly, they believed that the Syrians were techno experts of outer space.
What was the backstory behind it? I mean, who was in contact with him, and what did Al Bielek say about it, or did he remember anything about that?
Well, I don't remember specifically what Al said. I mean, Al would have parroted what I just said, or maybe given more details. Preston always said that the Syrians were the technical wizards between all these different alien races. All this stuff is hard to pin down. George had an interesting background, but it was kind of sketchy. And people would be dismissive of him because he had an alcohol problem. But I found out that his alcohol problem started when he was involved with Montauk, so it's like he was drinking to cope with it. He was very intelligent man, very unique. What his background was, he had, I knew him, but I mean, his back, he had a weird background, all I can say, but it was more of a metaphysical background where he had weird experiences throughout his whole life. I think it changed at the age of 12 where he saw Duncan Cameron coming through a water tower or something. It was very surreal. So his experiences went back. And then when he met Duncan in real life, it was like, wow. So he was just, I mean, if you were to meet him, he was like a regular person. If you were to talk to him, you'd find out there was a depth of mind-altering experiences.
Yeah. That is interesting there about the chair. Do you believe that? Do you believe there really was a chair?
Well, there was definitely a chair of sorts. And certainly the chair is a fundamental theme that you see. You see it in the movie Total Recall. You see it in the movie Clockwork Orange, where it's more of a torture device, mind control. But it even goes back to the earlier legacy of the barber chair. You know, the chair, or the chair of the Oracle of Delphi. The chair is kind of like an archetypal reference point that somebody sits in, like, you know, to meditate or whatnot. And then you know, when you start monkeying with people's minds. And of course, the chair was used very specifically at Montauk to pick up the thoughts of a person in the chair, which would then be amplified with huge devices called an amplitron, and then amplified and sent out the gain horn of the transmitter and tower to send and broadcast out certain emissions of what was going on in the person's mind, which would include moods. Basically, radar is very, unto itself, is very mood altering. So if you talk to people who've worked on a radar, around a radar installation, they'll tell you, oh, you know, we're turning on this frequency, now everybody's going to be happy, or now everybody's going to be sad. It does affect the moods of individuals. And when you tailor it and refine it, it goes even into more, I guess what you'd say, amplified reactions in people, where you could really tune it up. And this is where there were reports of animals going crazy, deer thrusting into a window. And we do have actual video footage of animals going crazy at Montauk in as late as 1993, when they were experimenting with radar. We show the radar installation, a mini portable radar installation. We show birds going absolutely crazy over the Montauk base. So that's it's just a scientific fact that this can happen. The refinement of it and the precision of it is a whole different ball of wax, where you basically have people tapping into the, I don't know how to better express it than the frequency of time, or moving into a different time reference, which is literally outside of this time zone.
Let's see here. Man, there's so many places I want to take you. There's two other ones I hope to get through. Here, I want to get to chapter 13. And you talk about where they brought in a secret crew here, where they were relaunching another project that was referred to as the Phoenix 3 project.
Well, that's the actual time project itself. Yeah, and it, just like they brought on a crew, like you can meet people who are aboard the USS Eldridge. Well, they weren't the people who were involved in the time experiments. They bring another crew and do it. And these are the guys that are going to do this, that, and the other thing. They did the same thing at Montauk. And that's where, I guess, the final coup de grace of the experiments takes place, where they're really, you know, and you could even make a good case for the fact that they weren't even from this dimension. I'm not saying that, but I think if I was writing the movie, I might either have them be from another dimension or have a connection to another dimension. Because the people that stay in this dimension, you know, it's, you know, they're only here. What would they be doing here in this dimension if they're manipulating time? Would they want to stay here? Probably not.
I mean, I've heard so many other people do, you know, at conferences and things like that, they lecture on, you know, being involved in time travel. Like, they really actually went there. And I think Andrew, what's his name? Basagio, or yeah.
Right.
He actually says he did that. And I'm wondering also, you discuss a Nazi connection there. this is just needs to be some kind of crazy movie. This needs to be a movie. Tell me what he told you about the Nazis being involved in it.
Well, one of the first things I heard when I sat down and heard my first lecture about this was all of the Nazi involvement on Long Island. And as I said, there were Nazis all over Long Island in the 1930s prior to the Philadelphia experiment. And of course, that they were out here as early as the, you know, pre-World War I. The Kaiser was building tunnels out there. The Kaiser had a pan-Germania movement across the world. He was expanding the German Empire. This was the, you know, Second Reich. But so there was a very strong German influence. The Germans also had superior technology, and there was a German liaison as early as 1936, I believe, maybe even earlier, out of the University of Chicago, where there was experiments being done or studies being done. And this was the collaboration between the United States and the Germans was quite strong. Charles Lindbergh, heralded aviator, was very strong for the German cause. He was going to be the next American president, but that plan was torpedoed, and he would have had a strong connection. He did not want war with Germany. But in any case, that connectivity kind of like stopped. It stopped, but it didn't stop. Preston's father worked at Republic Fairchild Airport in Long Island in Farmingdale, and he said that just before the war, all the Germans started shipping out. They just started disappearing, like they knew something was going down. So, but then again, there was still, I guess what you'd say, clandestine liaisons between certain factions of the U.S. Army and certain factions of the German Army, where there was Germans coming ashore. They did a whole search for Nazi gold buried at Camp Hero in, I think it was the 1970s, maybe the 1980s. I think it was the 1970s. It was, you know, I quoted the newspaper and everything from it, and they said they found no gold, but the U-boat captains might come aboard with gold, Nazi gold, and buy their ransom their way into a new identity as the war came to a close. So there were all sorts of secret collaborations that went on that were, you know, outside of the normal reference frame of World War II. And back in 1993, when we discovered this radar installation that was active out there on the bluffs of Camp Hero, and we saw the birds acting weird, it was the person who was running the radar, we found out, was from Brookhaven National Laboratory. He tried to have Preston and me arrested by the park police. But the radar installation was not on the park, actual park grounds. It was not in the what we call the forbidden zone, where there was fenced off. We weren't breaking any laws. He still wanted us arrested. He insisted that the park policeman would not arrest us because we weren't violating any laws. And we found out that Cardian Radar was at that time owned by Siemens of Germany, which was the electronic company of the Third Reich. Was owned that day, it was owned by Germany. So you see these old connections, they never die. And what were they doing with why were they operating a project, and it had a technician from Brookhaven out there on the Montauk base? It's just and then I later heard this guy, somebody who knew this guy, said, you know, he was very apologetic about what happened and was trying to be a nice guy or something. Just, you know, he didn't want us coming after him. His name was John Zacher. I don't know. These, you know, maybe the radar changed his mood. I don't know.
Wow. Let me ask you about, like, have you talked to anyone besides, I mean, everybody knows who Andrew is, but have you talked to any other children that supposedly were involved in these time travel programs?
Oh, well, yeah, there were many that used to surface, and they were involved in stuff, and or thought they were. They either were or they thought they were. Because, see, sometimes with the problem with all of them is that they cannot intelligently correlate their experience. That's the big challenge. Like, you know, Andrew will, you know, leave himself to be perceived as completely nuts. And he does not present a case like a lawyer would, even though he's a lawyer. So what you know, he's obviously been through some sort of mind control problem and program. And so these people have been mind controlled for the most part, if not exclusively. Therefore, their experiences are skewed and they're not coming out. And then it involves trying to gain attention and publicity. And the real, you know, the real thing I try to stick to is, well, what can we make stick? What can we make stick and what can we make not stick? With the stuff we can't make stick, we don't need to deal with it. It's just like we can tell a lot of stories. We can be creative if we want to. But so much of these stories I don't pay serious attention to because they don't go anywhere. They end up like a dead end. It doesn't mean that they're not true or that the people did not experience them, but it's just like riding a stationary bicycle. You don't go anywhere. So what was most intriguing in all of my research, probably the most intriguing thing, was the presence of a time control scientist who actually could effectuate time travel. And that was Dr. David Anderson, which he's mentioned in the book, and that was the, you know, sort of cherry on the cake of all the research I had done with the Montauk Project. And he had so many questions that he could answer on a scientific basis. And that led me to create the Time Travel Education Center.com, timetraveleducationcenter.com, where people can go and download or watch 7 free videos on that demonstrate that time travel is within the bounds of ordinary math and physics.
Like, okay, so I totally understand that these children that were involved, they are adults now. they can't really articulate their experience as well to prove anything one way or another. But has there ever been a scientist or anybody like that ever break ranks and come forward and do an interview and tell people that, yeah, it's true, what these kids experienced was true, anything like that?
Well, that's Dr. David Anderson. Now he said that the Montauk Project and is totally, this all makes sense to him very viscerally because he understands time. And he's created a time machine, although the only problem with David is that he's very reclusive and mysterious. I spent a whole 2 weeks with his wife last summer, not with him. And he's even mysterious and remote with his wife on these subjects. You know, he probably shares more with her than she let me know. But the thing is that, yeah, so it remains enigmatic. It remains enigmatic as much as there's hard science behind it, hard mathematical. The only time I've seen his time reactor was an early version of it when he showed it on a video to about 20 of us at Montauk in 2010 at a lecture that I was giving with others. And he participated, and it was very, I guess you'd say, low profile. He wouldn't let me take pictures of it. And we saw a flower basically grow in 3 minutes, what would normally take sprout up to in 3 minutes, what would normally take 3 or 4 days.
Man, wow, that's wild.
And that's a taste. It's like a tea.
Yeah.
It's like a tea. And that was 12 years ago. And I have not seen him since. I've talked to him. I've had long conversations. I've done some interviews with him, which are on my, you know, proprietary website, timetraveleducationcenter.com, which is by subscription. The videos are free. The math videos. So
when you say he built a time machine, what do you mean by that?
It's a time reactor. There's a patent for a time reactor.
That can do what?
Well, it can slow time down and speed it up. He's patented the application process, and I don't know. People might have to email me if they want. It might cause me a few clicks of the wrist, but petermoon333@gmail.com, say ask for the time reactor patent application, and I will send it to you or send you a link to it. He basically filed with the patent office how this thing works. Now, I've broken it down in different publications, given a more user-friendly explanation of it. The only thing I've seen of it was on the video that I just explained, and that was an earlier version of it, which that's all he created when I first met him in 1999. By 10 years later, 11 years later, he then had announced that he could send people back. It was now safe and big enough. There was a lot of power involved. And when I say, I'm talking about electrical power, and it takes a huge amount of power to power a time machine so it'll work. And this is all scientific. This is accepted by conventional science.
I'm interested to know about the patent. Okay, so for the patent, you don't really have to show, you don't have to demonstrate it working. You just have to show the science behind it that it is possible, correct, to be granted that patent. Is that correct?
Well, I think it has to pass certain tests of... It has to pass a certain metal, so to speak.
Who examines that? Do you know? I mean, there has to be...
The patent office, the patent office. And I must say about that is there was... I was doing an interview on some TV program that they would have... Well, they didn't... They cut much out of what I had to say about Dr. Anderson. They didn't show it, honestly. But one of the guys in the production crew, he said, I used to work at the patent office. And this isn't a patent because, you know, such and such. And I said, do you understand what a closed time-like curve is? He says, no. Well, there's your problem. You don't understand what it is, and it's in the patent. In other words, he didn't understand what he was reading.
See, that's what I'm saying. Who would check his work to approve his patent is what I'm trying to get at. I mean, it has to be someone that really understands it.
That you'd have to ask the patent office, but now there's also... There is a secrecy law, and you can look this up on Wikipedia. I forget exactly what it's called, but it's like patent secrecy. There is a provision in the U.S. code that if you have a patent and you apply for a patent which involves national security, that patent can be sequestered and basically not...
You don't have to tell anybody.
It goes under the table.
Well,
they kind of own it. And of course, the military disowned his work. He brought it to their attention, wanted to use it, and they poo-pooed it. Then he applied to get out of the military, which he eventually did, but they wanted to keep him at the last minute because they realized he had something. He had to petition his senator to get out, which he did. But then still, you're still an uneasy partner with him because they can claim anything they want on the grounds of national security. So he's, as far as I know, he's got an uneasy relationship with them. He came out publicly many years ago, and then he rescinded it. You know, he's got videos and all sort of stuff to show, he said, but he's not been able to release them. And I said to his wife last year when we were in Romania, I said, I told her about this dream I had, and she says, well, you know, you're basically communicating what he can't. He says, and you're doing a very good job, because he's not free to say certain things. Yet I don't work for anybody, so except myself. So I can say anything I want to, and you know that's kind of where that's at. This is at the horizon or the cusp of government secrecy, and I can only go so far, you know, with my experience and whatnot, and just report. This is as far as I've gone. I haven't gone any further. I haven't traveled in time myself or seen. You know, he's always said, well, yeah, I think he said it to me about 4 years ago. I don't think the time is too far off when you'll be able to come and see the lab. But that hasn't happened yet. He also said that when people have been exposed to the time reactor, and he says they often begin to laugh because they see that reality as they knew it is suspended. When you actually see it, it can create quite a sensation of laughter, and it can also create profound experience. Somebody who goes in the time field, he said, and some people will feel nothing at all.
I really have to ask you about Mars and why they were so interested in that planet and the Montauk Project.
Well, I don't know if it's explained in the book why. What I would say from some of the other work I've done, that Mars is by legend an ancient civilization that, you know, people from Earth came from Mars, and it's our home. If you, back when you know, I learned about little green men from Mars and all that thing when you, you know, exposed to science fiction. There was always something about the planet Mars that struck a chord that Venus, Mercury, Saturn, Jupiter did not. Something about Mars that was always special. I mean, it was often the premier planet to be featured from outer space, but there was an ancient race of blue people that were copper-based blood, and they settled, they came here, colonized in certain locations, going back as far as Atlantis. And if you were to, the ancient lamas of Tibet were recognized by the Tibetans to be blue. And the Celtic people represent blue. We have the word sacred blue, sacré bleu in French. That's a whole other different discussion. But Mars would be our ancient home by that theory. And theoretically, they came from Sirius. Now, these are legends, but they're pretty solidly ingrained in certain mythologies, if you know where to look for them.
Wow. I know that the entire book is amazing. I just have to ask you, is there anything that really shocked you about some of the things? I mean, all of it's shocking, but is something that really comes to mind that just really blew your mind?
Well, the most important part was David Anderson walking into my life. That was really something I never would have dreamed of. And I would say when I was writing the original book with Preston, I had a dream of where I time traveled with Preston. And he brought me back to 1943. And the time traveler, Duncan, said, yeah, there's a machine back there that needs to be fixed. He's pointing to me like I'm a mechanic. I said, I'm not a mechanic, but I was going back to fix something apparently in the dream. When I told Preston the dream, he says, oh, he says, that's wishful thinking. He says, this stuff is only a dream. It's only a dream. I mean, he didn't have any plans to make it happen. When Dr. David Anderson came into my life years later, Preston was in the same room with me. David took it to a whole new level. David has brought the goods. He's brought the bacon, says it is real. This was far beyond what I ever expected or anticipated. And although it's far beyond what I ever expected or anticipated, I still haven't seen the machine yet, seen it personally except on a video. So I'm patient. Maybe it'll happen. Maybe the way will be paved for it at the, you know, next year when, we'll see.
Very good. Why don't you take a moment, Peter, and tell my listeners where they can find out more information about you or any other books that you may be working on?
Well, the Montauk Project is something that never dies. It's evolved into all my adventures in Romania. You can go to petermoon.net and learn a little bit about myself. You can go to skybooksusa.com and look at the various books. You can also find and get the Silver Anniversary Edition. We still have a special running on the hardcover edition for $19.95, which is very inexpensive for what it would normally cost. And we also have TimeTravelEducationCenter.com.
All right, very good. All right, the book is called The Montauk Project, Experiments in Time. The book is written by late Preston Nichols and Peter Moon. This is the Silver Anniversary Edition, and many blessings to you, Peter, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
To find out more about our guest and all others, please visit our website at MysteriousRadio.com. And I want to give special thanks to our co-creator and executive producer, Kim Kyle, who brought this show to you today. And working hard behind the scenes, our team of four, I want to thank them as well. Follow us on social media and share the show with others that may like the subjects that we cover. I am your host, K-Town, and you're listening to Mysterious Radio.